Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On March 3rd, 2008, the court decided the case of Bulwar v. United States. The court held a distributee accused of criminal tax invasion may claim return of capital treatment without producing evidence that, when the distribution occurred, either he or the corporation intended a return of capital. Andy Grewal of Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meager, and Flom discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Attorney Grewal.
This is Andy Grewal, and I'm here to talk to you for a few minutes about Bulwar v. United States, in which the Supreme Court unanimously reversed yet another decision by the Ninth Circuit. Although the Ninth is used to getting reversed unanimously, this reversal is a little bit out of the ordinary. The court reversed the Ninth for being too favorable to the government in a criminal case, rather than, as is usually the case, the defendant. Bulwar didn't just deal with criminal statutes, but also dealt with a couple corporate tax statutes, and I'm guessing those statutes will strike most of you as esoteric or maybe even dull, but reduced to its essentials, Bulwar actually deals with a pretty basic question, which should be accessible to anyone, even if you're not a lawyer. The question is, can you go to jail for tax evasion even when you don't owe the government anything in taxes? In other words, is it a crime to avoid a tax liability that doesn't even exist? Now, most people would probably say this question has an obvious answer. You can't go to jail for tax evasion if you haven't evaded any taxes. But the Ninth Circuit effectively found that even if you have no civil tax liability, the government can argue that you do owe taxes for purposes of Section 7201 of the Code, which is a statute that makes tax evasion a felony. So, what was going on in Bulwar? In Bulwar, the defendant basically used his closely held corporation as a piggy bank, which, if you didn't already know, is a bad thing. Bulwar took around $10 million from the corporation and then used the money to buy all kinds of luxuries for himself, his wife, his girlfriend, and, in the words of Justice Souter, for the love child he had with his girlfriend. So, for example, when a customer bought goods from the corporation, Bulwar would make sure that the money didn't actually get into the corporation's hands. He would just tell the customer to write a check to him personally, even though the customer was really making a purchase from the corporation. But Bulwar got in trouble when he failed to report the $10 million he took from the corporation on his tax returns. The government charged him with criminal tax evasion under Section 7201. Now, it's extremely well established that there needs to be a tax deficiency for the government to get a conviction under Section 7201. So naturally, Bulwar argued that the $10 million he took wasn't taxable income to him. It was just a non-taxable return of capital, and he couldn't be convicted of evading his tax liabilities. The specific provision he invoked was Section 301 of the Internal Revenue Code, which tells you that one of three things happens when you get money from a corporation in which you own shares. Only the first two are relevant to this case, so I'm going to ignore the third for now. Basically, Section 301 says that when you get money from a corporation, it can be either taxable or non-taxable. If you get money in the form of a dividend, you owe taxes. But if you get it as a return of capital, you don't. So what's the difference between a dividend and a return of capital? So make it simple. You get a dividend when the corporation has made money and is paying you out of its earnings, and you get a return of capital if the corporation hasn't made any money and is just giving you your money back. Now, the logic of this is that if you give a corporation money and the corporation just turns around and gives the money right back to you, you shouldn't have to pay any taxes. Nothing has really happened. But if the corporation takes your money and turns it into more money and gives you the earnings, it's new income that needs to be taxed to you. Now, it probably sounds like Section 301 describes a very objective approach. If the money comes from the corporation's earnings, you pay tax since you got a dividend. But if the money is just a return of your investment, you don't have to pay anything. But as we're going to see in a second, the Ninth Circuit thought the statute turned on subjective factors, not objective ones. Anyhow, as criminal trial, Bulwar wanted to argue that the $10 million he took from his corporation was, in fact, a return of capital, so he didn't owe any taxes. But the trial judge wouldn't let him enter that defense, and Bulwar was convicted of tax evasion. Bulwar then appealed to the Ninth Circuit, but the appellate court upheld the trial court's decision. Specifically, the court followed its earlier decision in Miller v. United States, where it said that a criminal defendant couldn't use the return of capital defense unless he showed that either he or the corporation intended that the money given to the shareholder be treated as a return of capital. In other words, the court replaced Section 301's objective test, which just looks to whether the corporation has made money, with a subjective test that looks at the party's intent. But the Ninth Circuit didn't stop there. It said that its subjective test applied only in the case of criminal proceedings. So when you're filling out your tax return, you can apply Section 301 objectively. But if the government wants to charge you with tax evasion, Now you need to provide some evidence that you passed the subjective test as well to prove that you did your taxes right. This is a pretty bizarre approach, as you can probably tell. Now, to give the judges on the Ninth Circuit a little bit of credit, its decision wasn't perfectly unanimous. Judge Thomas concurred but noted a logical fallacy in the majority's approach. Their approach allowed a defendant, to use Judge Thomas's words, to be criminally sanctioned for tax evasion without owing a penny in taxes to the government. Judge Thomas said that if he weren't bound by Ninth Circuit precedent, he would just follow the approach previously taken by the Second Circuit, under which you don't need to satisfy a subjective judgment test to establish the return of capital defense. Anyhow, Bulwer petitioned the Supreme Court for cert, and in light of the split between the Second and Ninth Circuits, the court granted the petition. Justice Souter wrote the opinion for the court and completely rejected the Ninth Circuit's approach. The court said that the language of Section 301 turns on facts wholly independent of intent, specifically, whether the corporation has earnings. That's what makes it taxable. There just was no textual hook in the statute for the Ninth Circuit's subjective test. The court also pointed out that the presence of a tax deficiency is an essential element of the crime of tax evasion. You can't go to jail for avoiding a tax liability that doesn't exist, a point that the Ninth Circuit didn't seem to understand. But in a minor victory for the government, the Supreme Court did remand the case to allow the Ninth Circuit a chance to address an argument that the Solicitor General made for the first time in the Supreme Court. Now, in most ways, the Bulwer opinion is pretty unexceptional. No one, except for the Ninth Circuit, actually thinks that a subjective judge-made intent test should trump the objective test that Congress has provided in Section 301. The Supreme Court didn't settle a controversial issue in Bulwer, but really just corrected a severe mistake by the Ninth Circuit. Nonetheless, there's a couple of things that make this case pretty interesting. For one, Bulwer presents an extreme example of the government changing its litigating position once a case gets to the Supreme Court. The government argued at trial and on appeal that a subjective test applied under Section 301, but once the case reached the Supreme Court, the Solicitor General didn't even defend the Ninth Circuit's reasoning. Presumably, it would be very hard for him to stand in front of the justices and say that Section 301 meant one thing for civil cases, but another for criminal ones. That would just fly in the face of basic principles of statutory interpretation. So, the Solicitor General made a new argument, which the court said could be considered on remand. Anyway, for anyone interested in cases where the government sticks to one argument all the way to the Supreme Court but then totally changes face once it gets to the Supreme Court, Bulwer is a great case to look at. But what's most interesting about Bulwer might be its dicta regarding a taxpayer's right to avoid taxes. Around 70 years ago, in a case called Gregory v. Halvering, Judge Learned Hand said that anyone may arrange his affairs so that his taxes shall be as low as possible, and there's not even a patriotic duty to increase one's taxes. When Gregory v. Halvering reached the Supreme Court reiterated Hand's statements, saying that the legal right of a taxpayer to decrease his taxes or altogether avoid them cannot be doubted. Now, this notion that a taxpayer has a legal right to avoid taxes has been extremely controversial. In fact, the court has not said as much since 1960, and many people have tried to debunk the notion that there is a right to avoid taxes. But in footnote 7 of Bulwer, the Supreme Court quoted its 70-year-old Gregory decision and reaffirmed the principle that a taxpayer has a right to avoid taxes. The court also said that when analyzing a taxpayer's transaction, there's no general anti-abuse rule that floats over the entire Internal Revenue Code. Instead, courts have to examine each statute involved in the case. In other words, in a tax case, the question for determination is whether what was done was the thing which the statute intended. Now, that approach is pretty different from the lower courts and the IRS's approach to tax cases. Sometimes the lower courts will hold that no matter what a statute says, a taxpayer must, for example, have a business purpose to qualify for a tax benefit. So, if a taxpayer enters into a transaction solely for tax reasons, the argument goes, his bad intentions prohibit him from enjoying tax benefits. But Bulwer flatly rejected the imposition of an intent requirement onto Section 301, and it might become more difficult for the IRS to argue that a pure tax avoidance motive deprives a taxpayer of tax benefits. Already, in one very important case involving a corporate distribution, Hines v. United States, the taxpayer has filed a notice of supplemental authority with the Federal Circuit, but the case is pending, to alert the court of the Bulwer decision. And in a criminal tax case pending in the District Court for the Virgin Islands, U.S. v. Ferguson, the defendant has argued that the Supreme Court's decision in Bulwer requires that the indictment against him be dismissed. Other taxpayers and criminal defendants are probably doing the same thing. So, insofar as the development of the tax laws go, the key part of Bulwer might not be its rather ordinary holding regarding Section 301, but rather its dicta regarding the role that tax avoidance plays in statutory interpretation. No one, of course, is going to say that Bulware footnote 7 will obtain the prominence of footnote 4 of Caroling Products, but we will likely see the lower court spend a lot of time fleshing out the true meaning of Bulware's 7th footnote in the coming years, and it will be fun to watch. Anyhow, thank you for listening in, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUScast. For more episodes of SCOTUScast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.